Our next case is 20-13-1984, Cincinnati Bar Association versus Damon. Mr. Borchelt?
Yes.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, Joe Borchelt on behalf of the respondent, Jeff Damon. Mr. Damon is here to my left. At this time, I would respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal. The inquiry today is whether Mr. Damon has anything left to be fit for the practice of law. We do not disagree that crooks and con artists are unfit to practice law. However, as we will demonstrate in these short 15 minutes, Mr. Damon is neither of those things. I look at this case in a very simplistic view. I'm not an expert in disciplinary law. I'm not an expert before this court. But this court is designed to discipline and to monitor our profession, to determine whether the attorneys who practice law in this state are fit to represent the needs of the clients in the state of Ohio. And Mr. Damon, based on the record evidence in this case, is simply arguing that permanent disbarment is not the appropriate sanction. He is asking this court for a second chance, and he's asking this court to give him a sanction of an indefinite suspension to permit him to do the things he needs to do to be able to practice law in the state of Ohio. My argument today is going to focus on four primary issues with respect to the board's findings of fact and conclusions of law. The first issue that I'm going to address is the issue of restitution. The board, in its findings of fact and conclusions of law, found that there was some ambiguity or uncertainty with regard to the amount of restitution. And also there was sort of a side issue in terms of whether Mr. Damon understood his duty to fully reimburse his clients. The second issue I'm going to address is the idea in the board's decision that Mr. Damon was uncooperative in the disciplinary process. And we certainly believe that there is record evidence to the contrary, and I'll go through that a little bit later in my presentation. The fourth issue is the idea from, again, the board's decision, the recommendation, that Mr. Damon was not remorseful for his conduct. Certainly, we understand there is a subjective component to that. However, we submit and what we believe will be established is that the record evidence suggests to the contrary. Just briefly, a recitation of the facts, or more accurately, the conduct that was at issue. And to understand this, there's really two separate sets of disciplinary conduct that we're talking about. The first set has to deal with his former employer, which is the Butkovich and Crosswaite law firm. And then the second set of disciplinary conduct deals with Mr. Damon's representation of certain clients, and those clients are set forth in the briefing. It is undisputed in this matter that Mr. Damon was charged with and convicted of a felony in relation to his employment with the Butkovich firm. In that conduct, Mr. Damon, when he came from his solo practice, did not close his trust account, continued to fund money into that trust account, and then at the point where the Butkovich firm approached him and said this money was supposed to go to the firm, Mr. Damon promptly acknowledged the conduct, turned over all of his bank records, and very promptly started beginning to make restitution.
Well, counsel, there's a stipulation that that's at least $84,000, correct?
That is correct,
Your Honor.
And
the panel found that this may not have been the actual amount. Is that correct, too?
That is correct, and that's an excellent transition into the first point. There was a stipulation. The Bukovich firm, there was also a criminal proceeding. They had hired an accountant, a local attorney by the name of Jack Mueller, to go in and determine the amount that was taken. The full records were produced. Jack Mueller was paid a handsome sum to go in and determine what that amount was. Then, under the advice of counsel, Mr. Damon had come up with an agreed stipulation. In fact, on the stand, Joe Butkovich, I believe it's page 59 of the transcript, admitted that this was a stipulated amount. The only testimony that the board relied on was some testimony from Mr. Butkovich where he said there were other cash transactions that we didn't know about. Well, my first question is, why didn't their forensic accountant account for that? Obviously, Mr. Damon is in a criminal proceeding. He's being advised by counsel about what the amounts are. If someone would have come to Mr. Damon and said, Mr. Damon, we're going to agree, and here's your stipulated amount that the Butkovich firm is going to agree to. However, there are certain assumptions, such as cash or other items, and we're going to ignore those for now, but then we're going to use them against you later on in a disciplinary proceeding to say that there wasn't full restitution.
Well, were the cash transactions put into the accounts that the CPA was looking at?
Your Honor, honestly, I don't know the answer to that. I would assume so because it was stipulated.
It was stipulated to what?
It was stipulated to the amount that was due in restitution.
$84,000, but then they said, but wait a second, that's what we can determine from the bank records we've taken a look at, but we know that there were also cash payments made to Mr. Damon here.
That's correct. Your Honor, the stipulation was in the criminal proceeding as well as in these proceedings as to what the amount of restitution would be.
So you're saying once they agreed to $84,000, even if they found out later that your client had taken $100,000 in cash and put it in his pocket without running it through an account, that's too bad. They're stuck with the $84,000.
Your Honor, the $84,000, I don't believe, is the full stipulation. I believe it's more than that because if you look in the record at what the criminal proceedings, he had already paid, I believe it was $55,000, but then there was award of restitution, I believe, in the amount of $64,000 on top of that. So the actual amount of restitution is in excess of that $84,000. I think where the $84,000 number comes from is that's the number that Mr. Damon, I believe, when he prepared his tax return, that's what was listed as his income during that time frame as sort of gross receipts. So, but the issue, Your Honor, is this. The board is looking at lack of full restitution almost as an aggravating factor. That's not the case. Mr. Damon has asked this court for a remand and has said, if we don't fully know it, let's get it. Hire Mr. Mueller again, whatever the situation is. He's at the time acting under the advice of counsel to say this is the figure we have. If there had been any confusion as to that figure, then Mr. Damon is here and he said in his briefing, he said on the record, I want to fully pay back that money before I can practice law.
What about the panel's statement that your client felt he had no duty to pay back anything unless he was sued?
Well, Your Honor, that's not an accurate finding, and I'll explain why. First of all, the board doesn't cite any part of the record where that occurred. And in fact, the opposite is true. If you read the record, multiple occasions, Mr. Damon acknowledges that for any fees that are unearned, he owes that money. So there has never been any question that if he didn't earn a fee, he owes that money. The reason this came about was this. There was work done on these cases. Mr. Damon worked these cases up. This isn't a situation where he took the money, used it for something else, and then did nothing. He always took these cases with the intent of doing something. Lisa Thompson is a prime example.
Would that be true, the suit against General Motors when they were in bankruptcy?
Your Honor, on the record, Mr. Damon testified that he believed that suit could go forward. He believed that once the new corporation emerged from bankruptcy, that could go forward. Now, They may disagree that he believed that, but that's certainly on the record. In that situation, it was at a time a client had come to him. He had done some prior work, and the client believed he was aggrieved. And certainly, once the case was filed, there is no indication, and no one has suggested, that it was done without an understanding that there was possibly some light at the end of the tunnel. But going back to the issue, I
don't get the light. There's been all this publicity recently about the victims of these faulty ignitions, and they've got that hump of the bankruptcy to get past. I mean, that's not something that the average non-lawyer who turns on their television set wouldn't know.
Your Honor, I've debated with lawyers when they file cases against my client about whether there's any merit to it. I've had situations where the demand letter is so ambiguous. I don't know if they're alleging a cause of action or what the situation is. And this client believes they were wronged, and they come to these lawyers and say, "We were wronged. Something was done." And I've been in situations where, for whatever reason, whether it's a business judgment, that client does get some recompense. It's not always.
What about the Robinson case?
Your Honor, the Robinson case is a case where Mr. Damon had respectfully submitted that he did perform work on that case.
$25,000 is what he took. He filed a lawsuit, dismissed the lawsuit because he couldn't find an expert to support his malpractice claim, and has not refunded any of the $25,000. And he never kept itemized records of his activities there. That's $25,000 out of someone's pocket.
Your Honor, let me first say that Mr. Damon agrees on the record accounting issue, and certainly there's no excuse for that, and he's acknowledged that.
Didn't he try to discharge all those claims in bankruptcy?
And I'll get to that, Your Honor. Can I answer the Robinson question first?
Please.
Because I do want to address that. The Robinson case went on for a period of years. It was a unique legal issue. Robinson had sued a very reputable local workers' compensation firm for failing to get him the full amount of compensation. There was a side issue in that case about whether his workers' comp attorney, Mr. Clemens, had to turn over his entire file under the Hearn versus Ray implied waiver issue. That was briefed. Mr. Robinson was deposed for a full day. Mr. Damon took the deposition of our clients. Mr. Damon could not find an expert giving all those facts that could testify on his behalf. Mr. Robinson's case was dismissed, and Mr. Damon was fully prepared to refile it to attempt to find another expert. He was up against a summary judgment motion, and you know, in full candor to the court, the reason I'm aware of this, I was opposing counsel in Robinson. And I'm not here to testify, but I do know that if $25,000 was most certainly earned, and again, I know I'm not testifying.
But there's
I know
no
it's on
records.
The record.
There's no records, counsel. It's.
I agree, Your Honor.
All right, there's an egregious, performance right there.
You're right, but Your Honor, let me make this point. Mr. Damon wasn't taking fees with the intent of not doing anything.
Okay. Now, all right. Let's move on to Justice sure. O'Donnell's question.
The bankruptcy. The implication with the bankruptcy is that Mr. Damon somehow filed the bankruptcy in order to try and get around these claims. And that's not the case. What's in the record is that Mr. Damon was under substantial tax pressure. He went to an attorney. He filed a bankruptcy. He was informed that as a matter of federal law, you must list all of your creditors. He was then asked at the hearing, well, wasn't truly the intent of this, ultimately isn't the end game that you're going to wipe out all this debt? And he was trying to explain, got interrupted, and said, it's not as simple as that. I understand that even if I go through this bankruptcy, I still have to pay through the client security fund. He always acknowledged that. He said, even had I succeeded in this bankruptcy, I would have had to pay back the client security fund before I can be reinstated.
How much
to the
has the client security fund paid out in this matter?
I'm unaware of that information, Your Honor. However, I do know this. The client security fund and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, what they do is they attempt to determine, we're talking about unearned fees. He did some work, so there's some fees he's entitled to and perhaps some he's not. You can objectively verify that. You can see how many depositions were done. You can see what amount of time went in to some level. And I believe that's what they're doing. And there are cases where attorneys were indefinitely suspended prior to making full restitution. He's made restitution to some. It's in the record. He paid Bodegam $10,000.
What's your client doing now?
He is working as a paralegal for the Blake Maislin Law Firm, doing personal injury defense, paralegal work, a very successful and reputable plaintiff firm. He also works two jobs in order to attempt to pay restitution. He works nights and weekends at Best Buy. He is still paying restitution through the Hamilton County Probation Department, and most certainly—
That's to the law firm.
As to the law firm, that's correct.
But not to these clients that we're talking about, who will now have to go to the client's security fund.
He has paid some. He has paid some. But he has never indicated that he will not pay them back. And you have to put it in perspective. The question is, why didn't he go to them? Why didn't he go when the disciplinary issue come down and say, look, here's what happened. I owe this money. Well, number one, there is record evidence, at least in some cases, he believes he did all the work. So that's for someone else to decide. But there are others where he admits he owes the money. His biggest proponent of the criminal conviction has already said, and this is the Bukovich firm, we've got four malpractice cases. Our malpractice insurance has gone up 40%. He's got a criminal case where he's being advised by counsel. Now we're going to ask him and say, we need you to go to these clients and perhaps have some additional detriment that goes to the firm. So it's not as if Jeff Damon's trying to hide it or saying I don't owe it. He's got a criminal case where he's being advised by counsel. So to say that he doesn't understand his action is simply not accurate. It's simply not reflected in the record.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hollingsworth.
Morning, Your Honors. On behalf of the Cincinnati Bar, we believe that the evidence that was presented in this case, the undisputed evidence, demonstrated a pervasive pattern of theft. Mr. Damon stole money from his law firm, but he also engaged in numerous acts of misconduct that were also tantamount to theft. The victims of that misconduct were Mr. Damon's clients. The panel in this case found 22 separate violations of the rules of professional conduct, including the felony conviction that has already been discussed. The violations in this case spanned more than a 3-year period from about April 2008 through about July 2011. And I think it's important to point out that Mr. Damon wasn't a novice. He's admitted to the practice since 1984. So about the time he started engaging in this misconduct, he was about a 25-year practitioner. These multiple violations of the rules injured 8 different clients, as well as the law firm, the Butkovich Law Firm, where Mr. Damon worked from January 2009 to July 30th, 2010. After carefully listening to the evidence, carefully reviewing the evidence, the panel in this case unanimously ruled that permanent disbarment was the appropriate punishment. And they made it clear that their reasoning was that there were significant, in their own words, aggravating factors that outweighed the few mitigating factors. The Cincinnati Bar Association supports the panel's recommendation. Let's focus on those factors. As this court has repeatedly said, in the case of misappropriation, the presumptive discipline is disbarment. That's undisputed in this case. There was clear misappropriation. So the case really turns on the factors. And I'll just go through these factors. And I will challenge some of the stuff that was just argued by counsel for Mr. Damon. First factor, dishonest or selfish motive. That's undisputed based on the facts in this case. Second, a pattern of misconduct. The facts demonstrate a pattern of Mr. Damon over a long period of time of diverting money that should have gone to his law firm that was paying him $120,000 a year salary. That's not all. He was also, there are several cases of this, where he took money from clients and basically did little or nothing. We also have another variation.
Were those clients of the law firm?
Those were clients that he brought, as I understand it, they were clients that he brought to the law firm when he became a full-time employee of that law firm. I'm not aware that he was servicing pre-existing clients for the law firm, but I believe those were clients he brought to the firm or that who engaged him at the time he was with the firm.
So was he permitted to keep those fees separately from the firm?
The testimony by Mr. Butkovich was absolutely clear that once he joined the Butkovich law firm, those clients became firm clients and the income was to come to the firm. As Mr. Butkovich also testified, he wasn't even aware that Mr. Damon was still keeping a trust account open where he was diverting the fees. That trust account was supposed to be terminated at the time that he became a member of the Butkovich law firm. I was talking about the various patterns. There are variations on a theme here, but they all involve some form of theft or acts that are tantamount to theft. Another type of behavior that he engaged in, and we have several examples of this, is he would take a case that clearly had no merit. And I'll give you a couple examples. Clearly had no merit, take usually about $5,000 from that client, file the suit or file the motion, whatever the particular project was, and as soon as it was challenged, usually with a threat of sanctions by the other side, he quickly dismissed it or withdrew the motion. And there was never any accounting to the client for the $5,000 or whatever amount that he took.
Were those the funds that were diverted to the private trust account?
I believe they were.
Were they not simply deposited into the firm account?
I don't think those particular, I'm not positive where they went to, but what I do know is, for example, the Lisa Thompson case. This is the lady who wanted an accommodation on the LSAT and wanted University of Louisville Law School to give her an accommodation. She got the accommodation, and then a year later, Mr. Damon files a lawsuit under, I think it's Part 3 of the Americans with Disability Act. It's not the employer section, it's the public accommodation section. It only allows for two remedies, the accommodation and attorney fees. She already had the accommodation. She had had that for a year. So Mr. Damon files a federal lawsuit, charges her $5,000, and when the attorneys for the defendants point out, you don't have a claim here, he promptly dismissed it, and then later said at the hearing, he didn't know when he filed the lawsuit that she didn't have any attorney fees to get the accommodation. Nevertheless, he does it. He can't, as he admitted, and I'll show you the testimony, he admits he didn't know how much time he spent on this case. It didn't get past a complaint. The defendants didn't file an answer. They threatened Mr. Damon with sanctions, and as soon as that happened, he dismissed both defendants out of the case. But there's never been an accounting of what he did there. And basically, he can't do it because, as he testified repeatedly at the hearing, he doesn't keep time records. There's also another example, and this is the Du Bois. It's a female. I forget her first name now, but Ms. Du Bois.
Counsel, all this information we're familiar with on the various shortcomings of his representation. Can you address the appropriateness of a disbarment as opposed to an indefinite suspension? I think that's the crux of why we're hearing this case this morning.
Yes. It does come down to, as I was saying before, the mitigating versus aggravating factors. In our case, the panel correctly identified seven aggravating factors, and I was just going through several of them. I would like to discuss a couple of them more because I think they're very important. But the aggravating factors all support a permanent disbarment. The cases in this area, as you all know, involve a variety of fact patterns. There was a criminal conviction here. That was very important in determining whether permanent disbarment is the appropriate remedy or not. But in addition to the conviction itself, there was also a pattern of dishonest behavior that amounted to theft with eight different clients, not excluding the law firm. There were eight different clients over a period of time, and they're very common fact patterns in those various cases. There really was no remorse, and I'll give you
counsel
a couple
that
of examples.
Getting to that point on the cooperation and the remorse and the restitution, we heard counsel talking about counsel's suggestions to the client, so that there may have been legal advice given as to what to say, what not to say. How do you respond to that? Because that seems to be something that would affect whether this should be considered an aggravating factor.
Right. The undisputed facts are, whether we're talking about the Thompson case or the Michael Long case against General Motors, there is no evidence that Mr. Damon advised them about the weakness or non-existence of their case. None. Two, he cannot give us any documents on how much time that he spent in the Long case against General Motors, in the Thompson case against Louisville. All he did, or what his conduct consisted of, was filing a complaint. Yet he can't document how much time.
But my question was, how do we respond to the statement that he was acting under the advice of counsel when he did not answer certain questions, perhaps the issue of restitution or refusal to acknowledge conduct? That was my question.
I can only say that in connection with our investigation, there was never a refusal to answer questions. I don't know what that has reference to. Maybe they're referring to the criminal prosecution.
Well, isn't that part of the aggravating circumstances we're talking about here in paragraph 60? Lack of cooperation in the disciplinary counsel, in the disciplinary process?
The panel is talking about Mr. Damon's testimony at the hearing.
Right.
That's what they're talking about. And I'll give you examples of.
But did we not we not hear counsel say that his attorney was telling him things to say or not to say?
Mr. Damon, as I recall, was pro se at the hearing.
All right.
He had no counsel.
Okay.
Okay. But let me give you an example of an evasive answer. This is on page 109 of the transcript. And we are talking about the Lisa Thompson case. It takes me over a page just to establish that he doesn't keep time records, in particular in this case. Question. It's your practice, or at least during the time period that is in question from 2009 forward, you don't keep time records. Answer. I generally will record time I have put in. But I do not always use time slips for every file. No. Question. I'm not sure what that means. You're filing a lawsuit in federal court where if you request attorney fees, you know that you're going to have to give the court a detailed statement of what your time records are, right? Answer. If it comes to that, yes. But as a matter of practicality, you don't keep detailed time records, do you? Answer. Quite frequently, employment cases do not lead to a segregated attorney fee award. Many times it is settled with one lump sum number, and that has been my experience most of the time. It has been very rare that an itemized attorney fee award has been granted. Question. Did you hear my question? Answer. Yes. Question. Would you answer my question? Answer. I can't remember what it was. Question. You did not keep itemized time records for this case, did you? Answer. No. Took a page and a half just to get him to acknowledge that he never kept any time records in a case. Remember, what was the remedy he was supposedly seeking? Attorney fees. And he's not keeping time records in this case. And I think the reason is clear. He knew this case had no merit. It wasn't going to go anywhere.
How much restitution is owed, please?
I honestly can't tell you. When we put the first stipulation together, we were relying on information we had in the 2009 tax records. The prosecution part took place after that stipulation. So I didn't work with the prosecutor. I don't know how they worked out the numbers. If you look at the judgment entry that I believe it's Judge Myers entered, I think she ordered restitution, additional restitution, of about $56,000.
I could have done that in a page and a half.
All we had during our investigation was an admission that he had taken or diverted at least about 84, I think that was number 1,000, and then he provided to us information where he paid back about 54. That's what we had. We later got testimony from Mr. Butkovich at the hearing that they weren't confident that they knew what the exact number of the diverted amount was or what the restitution was.
But you did agree then the stipulated amount was $84,000.
We agreed to that, yes.
Yeah, and you
we
would,
pointed
you,
out we got it from the tax return. It's in
right.
the stipulation.
But you would agree that any subsequent restitution may very well be the result of the client's security fund dealings, and that's not before us here.
That's true. I don't know what the status
that's,
of that is.
That is, if these clients apply for reimbursement for the acts of Mr. Damon and they're awarded, then he will owe the client's security fund whatever dollars are expended.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's separate and apart, really, from what we're dealing here.
That's true.
For our purposes, his restitution is $84,000 in this case to his law firm.
That's what we stipulated here.
Okay.
Does your research show a case that you're relying on as to why disbarment is the preferred sanction as opposed to an indefinite suspension in a case like this?
Yes, I forget the case citation, but we do have several cases where there were criminal convictions and the mitigating factors did not outweigh the aggravating factors. And we've cited those in the brief. They all run together after a while.
All
to
right.
me, but
well, thank you very much.
Cite some cases.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may sum up in 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I bet you get tired of saying that. Everyone uses their time. Lisa Thompson comes in to Mr. Damon with a no probable cause finding and says, I have a limited amount of time to do something. I know I was wronged. It took him this delay to do it. Mr. Damon makes an assumption that she had attorney's fees. He's got a limited amount of time, so he takes the case and files suit, okay? He made a mistake because he didn't know she didn't have attorney's fees. That's a mistake. That's not fraud. Let's not disbar this man over mistakes. Leo Talika, the Talika case, is an individual who stole from clients, admitted he didn't do the work. When they asked for a refund, he said, no, you'll get it when you sue me. He threatened a client to push her down the stairs and bared his teeth at her. He got an indefinite suspension. Mr. Pritchard is another attorney, the Pritchard case, of an attorney who stole these client funds. And this court says, well, let's do this. Let's go back and determine the amount of restitution and make that part of the order. So the question again, does Mr. Damon have anything to contribute to our profession? And I respectfully submit that he does.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decisions.